24-year-old Jennifer Kessie disappeared January 24, 2006. She was last seen at her condo on Conroy Road.
We're going to solve a missing persons case, which has haunted Orlando investigators.
So we're still waiting for that one person to come through with the one bit of information that could bring Jennifer home.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessie in Orlando, Florida. I'm Sean Gerd. This episode has taken far longer to get to than we expected. It's time to bring you up to date on the possible suspects that investigators have considered over the years. To those of you who have followed this case closely, they will be familiar to you. Today we're going to talk about Jennifer's ex-boyfriend, her co-worker, and the quote-unquote construction worker. Before we start, I'll say up front that you will not hear from the known individuals, the ex and the co-worker, in this episode. And that's not for the lack of trying. We've been attempting to contact both for months, and all of our communications have gone unanswered. That's not surprising. Neither one of them has ever said a word publicly. But I know for a fact that one of them knows about this podcast, and I suspect both of them do. But even so, if you know them, make sure you let them know about this episode. I bring this up because I want to speak directly at both of them right now. If you are innocent, if you had nothing to do with Jennifer's disappearance, then it's time to speak up. We know at least one of you is innocent. But as you know, people have spent the last 11 years casting suspicion on you. By hiding in silence, it only makes that worse. There is nothing more that we would like to do than give you a form to clear your name. If you had nothing to do with this, every second that is wasted looking at you when everyone should be looking a different direction is an injustice for Jennifer. This is your chance right now. Our only agenda is finding Jennifer. Help us do that. Help us get you out of the way. Our contact information is easy to find on unconcluded.com. The time is right now. Do it for yourself and do it for Jennifer.
Seems pretty obvious to me, at least at this stage. That's where my mind is. I'm going to keep an open mind as we keep going. But right now, that's where I'm thinking we're at with this. My first impression, especially after watching the POI video and then learning about the construction workers, was that it was a construction worker just from looking at the clothing and seeing the pants and the shirt and the shoes, and it looked like some sort of a painter or some sort of, you know, somebody that was putting up drywall or something like that. And to me, that was the first thought that went into my head, just because it seemed to make sense pairing up that there were workers there and at the time and with Jen. You know,
this is Scott, way back during one of our very first conversations about this case. And his thoughts echo the same things I hear from almost everyone that I introduce to Jennifer Kessie's disappearance. They watch the POI video, they see what appears to be a person wearing all white, and they connect it back to the construction workers at her condo. And Scott's right, it does make sense. But then they go deeper and find the circumstances of these other suspects. And their opinions start to change.
Her co-worker's an interesting theory as well, just because of all the connections that seem to be there, and somebody that she saw every day, and somebody that was potentially interested in her. And, you know, to me, that's definitely one that you can't rule out. I mean, that one has my attention for sure.
I share these early conversations because I think it gives us a good reference point of the progression that takes place as people become more aware of Jennifer Kesey's disappearance. There seems to be so much more to it than the person of interest video. Yet, that's really the only concrete thing we have. Ultimately, people end up just like Scott. They go through and figure out all the information, and their conclusion ends up leaving them with more questions.
You know, and that's what I think, but really, you know, the reality of the situation is it could be anybody. It could be any of the people that we've discussed. It really could. I mean, there's nothing out there. There's no information out there to where you can look at it and say, yeah, they definitely didn't do it. That's just not the case. And right now, it's still wide open.
So it's time to talk about why it's so hard to narrow down on one of these particular suspects and how these same questions are still being asked 11 years later. So while we still continue to get leads and tips every day, we're going to hit the pause button on that for just a moment and make sure we're all on the same page.
I can't explain why he would come from the UCF area to the condo, to the mall across the street from Jennifer. I can't answer that. It's curious, for sure.
Several episodes ago, we concluded with that clip from my conversations with Jennifer's mom, Joyce. And we intended to pick up from that point in the following episode. But as you know, we had some tips to follow up on before we had a chance to get here. In that clip you just heard, Joyce is talking about Jennifer's ex-boyfriend. And this is what was so curious.
I know that Matt was at the Blue Martini at the Mall of Millennia the Monday night of Jen's abduction. I know that he lived near the UCF area. I know he didn't go to work. I believe it was reported that he didn't show up for work on Tuesday. I don't know. Jennifer could have, unless Matt would have had a weapon, Jennifer was strong enough that she could have overpowered him. I can't explain why he would come from the UCF area to the condo, to the mall across the street from Jennifer. I can't answer that. It's curious, for sure, because I don't know how familiar you are with Orlando, but the college, on a good day, is about 30 minutes from where Jen lived. You know, Orlando's a huge town, and just trying to get there. So I don't, you know, and Matt's never actually answered. For all I know, he answered to the police, you know, why he was there. I personally don't know why he was at that bar.
Okay.
At the Blue Martini. I don't know.
This is nothing new. If you have watched any of the television shows on Jennifer's case, you're likely to have heard similar information. Here's Jennifer's dad sharing on the ID Channel's Disappeared program.
He was actually devastated when they broke up, really devastated. And she had to fight that a little bit. He constantly just, you know, told her, I love you, I want you back. And she was telling him, you know, it's over. And we found out afterwards that he was actually in a bar, the Blue Martini, across the street from her condo the night she was taken, supposedly very, very drunk.
After hearing the account of what Jennifer's ex-boyfriend was doing on the night of January 23rd, and also hearing about how he was still infatuated with her, I have to agree with her family. It seems incredibly suspicious. It becomes even more compelling based on the fact that this ex-boyfriend is one of the friends that stayed with Logan in Jennifer's condo while she was on a romantic getaway with her new boyfriend. It's not hard to put together an escalation scenario ending in tragedy. An ex-boyfriend who by most accounts wants to get back with Jennifer, stays at her condo, which serves as a constant reminder, all the while she's off having fun with another man. And then just after that, he's at a bar across the street from where she lives the night she goes missing. It's pretty easy to see how he could end up on the investigator's radar. However, this particular individual has never been arrested, has really never been in trouble that I could find, and he was questioned by investigators just after Jennifer's disappearance and again several years later. So I have to agree with what Jennifer's mom told me during our conversation.
So do I think that Matt is involved? No, I really don't.
But gut feelings don't rule someone out. Evidence does. And we have to believe that the police have the evidence that rules him out. But we've heard it stated many times that they haven't ruled anyone out. And this individual continues to sit in silence. So what was he doing between the hours that Jennifer disappeared? And if he didn't show up to work the next day, why not? Was it just because he was hungover or something else? These are questions that need to be answered. And the only person that can answer them is the ex-boyfriend himself. But I can't stop thinking about how if the ex-boyfriend was so drunk that night, how did he pull off this crime and leave not a trace of Jennifer anywhere? That just doesn't make sense. And certainly by the next morning, he could have been in a different state. But it's still hard to imagine, especially considering the fact that he would have done it alone. We should be able to rule him out, but the answers to simple questions we don't have. So for now, the ex-boyfriend is still on the table. Now let's talk about Jennifer's coworker at Central Florida Investments, who is more or less the internet's number one suspect in Jennifer's disappearance. A simple internet search brings up dozens of pages discussing this person's possible involvement, much of it stemming from one particular source that we've previously mentioned in the last sidebar episode. Almost anyone who is introduced to this case and decides to look it up becomes fixated on this particular individual. But it's easy to see why.
She had people wanting to date her. One, though, he's been on the horizon since week one. He's in management.
The guy wasn't getting the message that she doesn't date work people.
She just wasn't that type of person who would get involved at work.
Our advice to her was to have lunch with him within the work atmosphere and explain to him very politely that you do not date work. To my knowledge, she did do that.
So the police have spoken to him?
Multiple times, sure.
That's Jennifer's parents speaking with Greta Van Susteren about this particular coworker, who was a manager alongside Jennifer. But it wasn't just this romantic interest in Jennifer that made him a suspect. In 2010, a complaint was filed against this individual, and the information in that complaint was a bombshell. I've obtained a summary of that complaint that I'm going to read to you now. Just keep in mind that the names involved have been redacted. So I'm going to use the terms the employee and the manager where the redacted names appear in the letter. Also remember that this is a one-sided account, and we have no way of verifying if this actually happened other than this one particular person's complaint. The letter is dated January 19th, 2010, and it reads as follows. The employee made an appointment to file a complaint against his supervisor, the manager. During that conversation, he mentioned that the harassment began after the disappearance of Jennifer Kessie. He said that before she disappeared, the manager and Jennifer were involved, and that was common knowledge. The employee indicated that Jennifer had gone on a cruise and that the manager was very upset and angry and had told him, "I don't know why she's hanging out with that guy. Why did she go with him on a cruise?" The employee said that he would tell him not to talk about these things because the manager was a married man. The employee then stated that on Monday, when Jennifer did not come into work, the manager came in very late and everyone noticed. He saw that throughout the week, The manager seemed very preoccupied. When they spoke about Jennifer, the manager told him she must have been eaten by crocodiles by now. The employee told him not to say things like that, and the manager ignored it. The employee said that he did not tell the police about the manager coming in late because he was afraid what happened to Jennifer would happen to him. He stated that he almost had a heart attack when he was called by the police. He thought that perhaps he was being seen as an accomplice because the manager and he used to hang out together at work. I told the employee that he should have mentioned this to the police and also let them know that he feared for his safety. The conversation at this point returned to his complaint, and he did not mention Jennifer Kesey again. The letter is then signed by the person who wrote the letter, whose name is also redacted. Now, before we go any farther, it must be noted that this particular account by this employee does contain some misinformation. Jennifer did not take a cruise. The morning she didn't show up would have been Tuesday, not Monday. And by all accounts from her parents and others, Jennifer was not involved with the manager. So was the manager allowing others to think that they were? It's a question to consider. And something that just doesn't make sense. But this letter can't be ignored. It contains specific information about an individual's actions after the disappearance of Jennifer. Actions that are incredibly suspicious. Of course, when I talked to Jennifer's mom, I had to ask her about the coworkers. And although she couldn't share much, she was aware of them.
Yes. And the name, and now I can say his name because it's out on many blogs, the Johnny.
We're withholding the full name here.
You know, he is someone that is still on the police's radar. Him, Francisco, and the guy Francisco's brother, which I can't remember his name, but I'm hesitating when I talk, and I know it sounds weird, but I have to remember what it is that I can say and what it is that the police don't want me to say.
So at least we know that this particular individual that we're calling the coworker has come under the radar of the police and has been looked at. But it's worth noting that this wasn't until years after Jennifer's disappearance. 11 years later, this person has not been implicated in the crime. So maybe they're innocent. But again, there's questions that need to be answered, and the only person that can answer them is the coworker. So another suspect with a convincing motive and strange surrounding circumstances. Now, there are plenty more other rumors and statements going around about this particular suspect. Rumors of trips to empty apartments and workplace cover-ups for illegal schemes, a lot of different things, but we've been unable to verify any of those. So for now, those aren't part of our investigation. But there is one particular rumor that we can clear up. It's been reported in several different locations that the reason the coworker was late on the morning of January 24th, the day Jennifer was reported missing, is because they received a traffic ticket, which they proceeded to rip up and get arrested for. And while that event did happen, it didn't happen on January 24th. It happened prior. So the reason that this particular suspect was late to work had nothing to do with the traffic incident. It goes without saying that the coworker is on the table in this investigation. There's just too much that can't be explained away. The last known suspect really isn't known at all. They're almost a mythical figure at this point. The person we're calling the construction worker. At the time of her disappearance, Jennifer's condo was a construction zone. Workers were everywhere. And yes, Jennifer had voiced concerns about them to her family.
You know, in the complex, Sean, there's so much that, I mean, in the complex, Mosaic, the Millennia, they had a lot of illegals working there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that from all of your investigation. And they were used to make catcalls at Jen, or they'd stop and leer, but they never said anything other than whistle. And Jennifer had told her friends, she had told some coworkers about it. Rob, her boyfriend, knew, and she had told us, and we told her that the next time it happens, go and talk to the sales manager and tell them what's going on, because you should not be subjected to that. Nobody should be subjected to that in the place that's their home, you know, by workers.
There's a lot of concerns around the construction worker theory, much of it stemming from the fact that many of those workers were hard to keep track of in the initial days, weeks, and months of Jennifer's disappearance. There's conflicting reports about whether law enforcement was able to track them all down or not, but from most of my research indicates that they were able to question and interrogate most of them. But I also do need to say that in our investigation so far, we have heard from others who had also endured this kind of harassment at the Mosaic at Millennia. We also have to consider that the construction worker suspect makes more sense based on the known fact of the person of interest moving Jennifer's car to the Huntington on the Green, and then the bloodhound tracking that person back to the Mosaic at Millennia. Maybe the construction worker was returning to work. That does make sense, I suppose. But some of the other theories and thoughts revolving around the construction worker just don't make sense to me. I don't buy into any suggestion that Jennifer would have been buried under concrete. Every construction manager or a contractor that I've talked to has said it would basically be impossible for that to happen. For one, because the amount of people it takes to complete such a project. And two, a foundation wouldn't have enough cement to cover a body. Do we really think that a single or even a small group of construction workers could make Jennifer disappear without a trace on their own? It would seem they'd need professional help, which then takes us back to a human trafficking type angle, which, based on our investigation to date, just doesn't seem likely. But Jennifer's mom had a slightly different theory.
I've always felt, and I know that, you know, this sounds far-flung, but I've always felt that, what if one of those workers, you know how trafficking works? You know, there's a coyote who brings them here from Mexico, whether they come in the by boat or they come, you know, in the back of a van. Well, what if somebody didn't have the money to pay their coyote, who was the person that got them their passage here? What if that person would have said, hey, I have this really beautiful girl, I can get her for you, and you let me be free? And this is not fiction. This stuff happens. So I've always felt that there's a good possibility Jen's in Mexico, only because that's where a lot of the workers were from. Drew, and everything that we know about human trafficking, and we've attended many seminars and what have you, the Eastern European countries are very big on human trafficking. And I don't know.
So whatever the motive of the construction worker would have been, I think we can all agree that there certainly was the opportunity for that person to be involved in Jennifer's disappearance. At the time of her disappearance, only a handful of the condominiums in her building were occupied. Many of them were vacant or occupied by the workers themselves. It isn't hard to imagine one of the workers seeing Jennifer's everyday routine and taking advantage of that. But the hardest part to figure out, if it was a construction worker, is where is Jennifer? The seemingly complex nature of her disappearance just doesn't seem to ring true with the construction worker theory. So while I personally consider this not as likely as many others, again, another suspect who we have to consider. It's fairly easy to make a compelling case against any of these possible suspects. Although in my opinion, there's one in particular that just seems a little more suspicious. But all three of these particular suspects, the coworker, the ex-boyfriend, and the unknown construction worker, have been under the suspicion of investigators at one point, and nothing's come of it. Likely because all of the so-called evidence is circumstantial. Known evidence has to be considered first, and so that means, again, we're looking at the person of interest. To me, it's pretty clear that the coworker and the ex-boyfriend are not the person of interest. So to entertain them as the responsible party, we have to also accept that there was someone else involved, an accomplice. Or that the person of interest had nothing to do with Jennifer's actual abduction, which, although unlikely, is possible. But keep in mind, there is one of these possible suspects who investigators have apparently attached family members to as part of their investigation. We'll talk more about why I don't believe either of those suspects is the person of interest on this week's sidebar episode. All that aside, to me, with how clean this crime appears, Jennifer literally gone without a trace, that's just the hardest part to comprehend, especially when we consider that these three known individuals, do any of them really seem to have the capabilities of committing a perfect crime? At least two of these individuals, if involved, would seemingly appear to have committed a crime of passion, the ex-boyfriend and the coworker. And crimes of passion are almost always messy. Not some carefully planned, premeditated attack, with every precaution and scenario considered. Was Jennifer's abduction carefully planned and executed? Or just extremely lucky? Either way, let's hope that luck is running out. And speaking of luck, about the person of interest who dropped Jennifer's car off at the Huntington on the Green, walked away, his face was completely obscured by posts in the fence, and no one saw anything. How is that possible? A large apartment building, full of people, and we've never heard from anyone who says that they saw anything in that complex. But things change.
And then the next morning, I'm watching the news and I see our parking lot there.
That's next time on Unconcluded. Remember, if you think you know anything about the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey, it's time to speak up. Call the Orlando Police Department and ask for the detectives in charge of this case. And don't hang up until you talk to them. We'll be back next week with our follow-up sidebar episode. Remember to submit your comments, questions, and theories over email, voicemail, or social media. You can find all of that on unconcluded.com. We've also added a timeline to the website that will continue to update as we continue this journey. Remember to come join the conversation on the Facebook group. Just search for Unconcluded Podcast Discussion Group. And lastly, before we go, stick around until after the credits to hear from our friends at the Minds of Madness podcast. Unconcluded is produced by Scott J. and myself. We'll see you next time.
What could an American dad a university professor, and a passenger on a bus possibly have in common? You can find out by listening to the Minds of Madness podcast, where we uncover the series of events and state of mind leading ordinary people to do unthinkable things. The Minds of Madness is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and all other major podcast apps.